This is a very challenging reading. And in a sense, it's not for everyone. I don't mean that the truths expressed here are not for everyone, but the single most important element on the spiritual path is that we must move sincerely from our actual perception of where happiness comes from and what causes suffering. The essence of the spiritual path, as Yogananda defined it in the first little booklet that was published under his name, actually written by a disciple, was called The Science of Religion. And Yogananda explained, Master we call him, Master explained that the science of religion is the longing within the human heart for happiness and the longing within the human heart to avoid suffering. It's not just human, it's all conscious creatures have the same desire. If you take an earthworm and poke it with a pin, it'll curl up and try to get away from you. So anything that's conscious is caught between these two realities, which is certain things cause us to suffer and certain things seem to give us joy. And naturally, we have a desire for those things that give us joy and we have an aversion to those things that cause us to suffer. Progress, the progression of learning in human life, in all life, is to gradually figure out, you know, where suffering comes from and how to avoid it, where happiness comes from, or joy, or bliss, which is a truer word, bliss meaning an unconditioned sense of happiness inside, where it comes from and how to maximize it. Now, the nature of the spiritual path is such that you can't persuade someone of these truths. You can't tell someone, you would be happier if there's no part of that individual's consciousness that responds to that. I watch, you know, as the generations change and I get old enough to follow, you know, to be able to see more than one generation happen, you see people who are 20 or 40 years difference in age having all sorts of ideas about what they want to do, how they want to look, how they want to decorate their bodies, what they like, what they think is fun. And a person who's had more years on the planet, as a rule, doesn't exactly vibe with the same realities, you know, on so many different levels. And they can try to tell me that this is really a great thing to do, and I can try to tell them that something else is a great thing to do. But each of us is moving quite sincerely through our own perception of reality. And we, of course, relate to each other and communicate with each other because that's how our perceptions of reality expand. I mean, many things that we have subsequently embraced have been first suggested to us by someone else. Or we saw someone else doing it, or we read about someone else doing it in some kind of a transfer of the thought, gee, this might lessen my pain and increase my bliss, so maybe I'll go that direction. Now, the question is, like, how far up that spectrum does this learning process go? And the nature of ego, which in the reading was referred to as man's attempt, all of the different ways man attempts to give more security to his fragile ego. It's a very interesting statement. Ego is the infinite self identified with this body, and then once identified with this body, subject to all the ups and downs that are inherent in the material world. The material world, as we can see just looking around, it's composed entirely of pairs of opposites, isn't it? You know, it was now, just today it's turned a little chilly, and those of us who still were clinging to our summer clothes have been sort of walking around shivering a little bit today, because inevitably this happens. And now we will go through what I lovingly call the bitter Palo Alto winter. And then we'll, because to me, anything other than a tropical island is some kind of cruel imposition by an unfeeling God. But anyway, but I know that if we just endure, we'll come out the other end. And what do you know? It's going to be summer again. And I read another reference to age. How many of us, I mean, all of us sitting here are older than we were a minute ago, aren't we? And we can remember being a lot younger than we are now. We can watch our little children grow up. I was in a line in a store where they had an insufficient number of checkout clerks yesterday. Fortunately, in front of me was a mother and her little son, Kyrell. Kyrell was 14 months old. Kyrell was just learning to walk. And you know how they walk? Like that. And Kyrell had an exquisite set of ears on his little head. These just marvelously sort of soft, flappy ears. And pacifier in his mouth. So he's staggering around with his little flappy ears and sucking on his pacifier. I said to his mother, the store ought to hire you just to stand in this line to entertain us while we wait for those people to come. But I kept thinking, oh my God, look at you. You know, you can't even feed yourself with a spoon. And, oh, you have so many places to go. And, of course, he's a little tiny thing, and his mother's a great big woman. And pretty soon, Kyrell's going to be a great big man, and his mother's going to be a shriveled old woman endlessly, isn't it? Now, if we think about this, and if we have any intuitive memory of perhaps past lives, which is, has to be part of this story, and that's one of the things that people have to cross over and even to get into this story, but this thought of, after a while, the intense pleasure of being Kyrell's mother and having this little baby, you know, flapping around her neck saying, I love you, mommy, you know, and mommy gets so excited because he loves her, you know, and this trait sense of happiness comes in, doesn't it? Until Kilroy says, gets to be a big teenager and says, get out of my face, you know, and then all of a sudden that which was so blissful becomes the cause of suffering. And if we're sensitive and think about it, we begin to wonder, isn't there some way to not have this happen? Right. So then Jesus comes along and he says, I come not to bring peace but a sword. I come to separate, you know, one from another. Who is your family? Not those. You know, it's just like if one is desperately striving just to have slightly harmonious relationships or something resembling a functioning family, and has done nothing but long for these human relationships, this is not good news, you know? And in fact, the Bhagavad Gita has this wonderful chapter, which I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't really think it's written exactly like that, but it talks about the progression. And it says, the first time we hear about these truths, which is really telling you that the immediate experience of your senses is not all there is to reality, and this deep identification with this physical body and all the things that it defines itself as is not all there is to reality. The first time the soul hears it, it doesn't hear it at all. It's like the words are not even spoken, or think even more than that. The first time it's spoken, the soul goes to sleep. Just instantly. It's like somebody starts talking to us about something we don't want to know. We just go to sleep. We just check out. And then we hear the words spoken, but we don't comprehend them. Then we vaguely comprehend them and immediately reject them. Then we become intrigued. That's an interesting point of view. And then we forget them as quickly as we can. And then gradually, we begin to hear it. And we can only hear it when it falls into the prepared cradle of our actual life experience. Now, when a person doesn't really understand this, it feels like all these good things are being taken away from us. And I've had people say, don't you believe in families? Well, I didn't write this. Jesus wrote this. This is so amusing to me because the fundamental orthodox approach to the teachings of Jesus puts all this emphasis on the family. But what did Jesus himself say? Jesus said, who is your father? Who is your mother? Except those who love God. And he said, I come to sever those ties. And he didn't mean fight with your family. You know, create as much dissonance as possible. Take up the sword and hack your relatives to pieces. That's not really what he was talking about. Because what they're really trying, now bear in mind, Jesus was a revolutionary and he had a very entrenched, the reality of a master has to be understood to understand what any master teaches. Which is even though that individual soul who incarnates as a son of God, a messenger of the infinite, Yogananda, Buddha, Krishna, Jesus, these masters come again and again, different souls come to carry the message. Even though individually they're free, and even though the teachings they bring are ultimately all the same, because the ways to escape suffering, the ways to experience bliss are inherent within us. Nobody can make them up and nobody owns them. But when the Master incarnates, he becomes, his capacity to share what he has to share becomes defined by the context into which he is incarnated. And they'll come, these masters come, as a result of the call of some mass of people, the prayers of many going up, and in the case of Jesus, the great religion of Judaism had been corrupted by a corrupt priesthood, and gradually the truth of it was being lost, but the sincerity of that karmic group drew a divine master again, as Moses had been, to renew that teaching. But, as the Jews write about themselves in the Bible, the Jews are a stiff-necked people. That's how they describe themselves. I'm just quoting from what they say. I'm one of them, and I believe it's true. But anyway, there you have it. Jesus had to fight hard. Plus, the priesthood, the corruption of the priesthood had an iron grip on people's thoughts and lives. So he couldn't just say casually, gee, you know, maybe the family, maybe there's a joy that's, you know, transcends the family. You know, think about it. He couldn't say things like that. He had to say, I come not to bring peace, I come to bring a sword, just to get the attention and to create the necessary challenge that would cause people to wake up out of all the things that were binding them. But the fact is, the stages, every aspect of human life is a stage of growth. And we see that when you look at children, little Kyrell staggering around the store, you know, wrapping his little arms around his mummy. If he were 40 years old, staggering around the store, wrapping his arms around his mummy like that, we would perceive that somehow or other, either by choice or by debility, he hadn't exactly done what he'd come here to do. Because there are stages of growth that we go through, and different actions are appropriate at different stages. We have in our minds this arbitrary cutoff point. You know, we become adults, and this is how adults live, and then we die, and many people think we go nowhere, but whatever it is. But the question is, are there stages of consciousness that we express through these bodies, and the body does not really define it? The age of the body is not really the age of the consciousness inside of it. The wisdom of the consciousness inside is determined by all of these learnings that we've been doing. Now, self-evidently, when we look around us, we see that there are degrees of understanding. And there are some who suffer less and some who have more bliss. And that doesn't mean that there are some who get away scot-free and nothing bad ever happens to them. It's just that some have a demonstrated ability to maintain joy and equanimity and generosity of spirit and inner happiness no matter what. And you see, that's for those of us who think about it for a while. We begin to think, now that's what I want. That's what really solves the problem of the fragile ego. Is to transcend with our consciousness the vulnerabilities of that ego. I had a very interesting experience, a very personal one, but it's appropriate to share. When I first got married, almost 30 years ago, I had been single for a long time, and I thought I pretty much had my, you know, my emotional act together. Ha! That's all I can say. And I went through one of those charming experiences that women sometimes impose upon their husbands, where the man is just blissfully going along with his life, and the woman is gradually getting more and more upset. I mean, maybe this never happens to anyone else, but occasionally it's happened to us. And so I was just in the house with David on a Saturday morning, and he was more or less innocent. And for reasons that I never communicated to him and I can no longer remember, I gradually got really upset with him. Until finally I was very upset and was just, you know, completely goofy is the only word I can use. There was absolutely no basis for it. But I was astonished to see how once we allow ourselves to become involved with one another, that also then we become open to all sorts of other possibilities. And I tried to reassure myself in that circumstance. Oh, well, he didn't really do anything. I just misunderstood. He's a good man, you know. Nothing bad will ever happen to me. I can completely trust him. You know, all the things that people say to each other. I love you, Mommy, the little baby says, and the mother actually thinks he's going to remember it when he's 15, you know, or 30. But I thought to myself, you know, certainly David is self-evidently a good man. But who is absolutely reliable, and who can promise never to accidentally walk in front of a bus and have one's whole personality changed by an accident? Who can say how long someone will even be on this planet? Who can say what kind of changes could come which just will make everything different than you think it's going to be? So I could see, just sitting there, if I made my fragile sense of security that now I have this person and he will do these certain things. You know, now I have my baby and I will never be alone anymore. You know, I have a wonderful mother and I'm always secure. But no human being, no matter how profoundly and deeply we love each other, can promise with a power that we don't have. Isn't that so? You know, it's just like we can't predict the future, and we do not have a complete clear picture of every vritti that's in us. We don't really know what our karma is going to be. And how many times, even with the most sincere motive, do we actually not quite manage to carry through? Just, it's, everybody means well, and all of us mess up. So I thought, I don't want to close off, because you see, that's how most people solve this problem. And in fact, that's how many people interpret the kind of scripture reading we have today. Oh, I should be detached. That means I should be closed. But being closed is an act of fear. Oh, if I don't want to open up because I might be hurt. And fear is the antithesis of an embracing of this world as God's reality. So what I persuaded myself of the simple truth, which is the forms that are given to us to love, family, sister, mother, father, brother, are a window for the power of the infinite to come through and touch us. And naturally, we should use common sense in our relationships to people. But the trust that we offer through the love of one another is actually the trust in the divine to give us whatever it is that we need that will draw us closer to that infinite bliss. And that was beautifully exactly what Sharmila chose to read today. Let me see every challenge that comes to me as a gift from the divine to gradually move me away from all suffering into infinite bliss. Because if we shift our sense of where our happiness comes from, away from the absolutely inevitable ups and downs of this world, to the unchanging power of the spirit which is playing through all the ups and downs of this world, you see? It's just exactly like a play. We so enjoy the drama and the excitement and the tears and the this and that of the actors on the stage. But we never make the mistake of thinking that that's really life. What we love is the skill of the actors and the beauty of the set and the magnificence of the plot and the power that manifested it. And we live through it. If you sit in the theater with your arms folded and won't listen, then you experience nothing. We can't live. That's not detachment. To be detached is to enter completely into the surfboard ride, you might call it, of this ocean of life. We just have to ride it. But what it is, it's the vast ocean under it to which we give our allegiance. And if we cling, if we say, no, 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 it's not really God's gift of this child, it's the child that I love, then gradually, not because God doesn't love us, but because he does, he says, oh, but you see, that's not really the bliss that you're longing for. Let me help you experience something deeper. And the more we resist that lesson, The more painful it is as God pries our fingers off of whatever we're gripping. The more interested we are in how much we can learn and how expansive our consciousness can become, the more we just ride the waves of life and find that bliss beyond. And in the meantime, you see, when the fragile ego is made secure by trust in the infinite, then how easy it is to be loving in this world. What is it that stops us from being so kind and open to one another? Isn't it always the fear of being hurt? If we transcend that fear of being hurt, because how could an infinitely loving divine mother ever hurt us, no matter what event she brings to our lives? You see, then far from detachment from the ups and downs, being a closing off in fear, it becomes an absolute willingness to embrace all as an expression of the divine.